V for Vendetta, novelization by Steve Moore, continued. Disc 3. Actually, though, now that she thought about it, she remembered that particular schoolteacher, intriguing though he might have been, was one of the ones she couldn't really bring herself to like. The one with a harsh, uncompromising view of the world, who saw everything in black and white and had no time for comfortable moral shades of grey, who had principles, the one who made her think too much, the agitator who would undoubtedly have been among the first to have had his head put in a black plastic bag. Not the bags the finger used as blindfolds when they took you away, though God knew she was terrified enough of those, the sort of bag they put a bullet through, that prevented the brains splattering everywhere. And then she couldn't help but feel, deep down in her bones, that the man standing before her, his true face hidden by the smiling mask, was exceptionally dangerous. Not just to the police, the state, or the world at large, but to her, personally as well. "I think I should go," she said abruptly, trying to suppress a sudden feeling of panic, looking round hopefully for an exit door. "May I ask where?" he said in a calm, calming and oh-so-reasonable voice. "Home," she told him, unable to think of anything else but all the safety and comfort that it represented, tawdry as it was. Strange how she'd been wanting to get out of the Paddington area for ages, to move to somewhere better. Now she couldn't wait to get back there.
"I have to go home."
"You know they're looking for you," he said slowly, patiently, as if he were having to explain things to a small child. "If they know where you work, they certainly know where you live."
"I have friends," said Evie desperately. "I could stay with them."
"I'm afraid that won't work either." She'd known he was going to say that, even as she mentioned the idea. Knew, as well, that he was right. She couldn't drag her friends into this by asking for help. Or rather, she couldn't drag them in any more. Undoubtedly, they would already have been pulled in for questioning, and not at all of a pleasant sort, and these days innocence was no excuse, no protection. "I want you to understand, Evie," V continued, turning away from her now as if the words he had to speak were rather too hard to say directly to her face. "I didn't want this for either of us, but I couldn't see any other way. You were unconscious and I had to make a decision. If I'd left you, right now you'd be in one of Creedy's interrogation cells. They'd imprison you, torture you, and, in all probability, kill you, in pursuit of finding me." Evie knew that every word he said was true, but still they sounded like a death sentence. And in many ways they were, for whatever happened now, the old life she'd had was over, irrevocably and forever. "After what you did for me, I couldn't let that happen." These words cut once again across her train of thought. "I picked you up and carried you to the only place I knew that you'd be safe. Here. To my home."
"I won't tell anyone," Evie pleaded, desperation giving way to terror now. "I swear. You know you can trust me."
"I'm sorry, but I can't take that risk." He turned back to face her now that the worst had been said, and everything else would only emphasize the point. "Have you ever been tortured? People say things they'd never believe they would." Looking at her, he could read exactly what she'd do. She was so frightened and confused she'd say anything they wanted to hear at the first sign of a threat, if only it would save her. She wouldn't want to. She'd never forgive herself afterward. But her resolve would just completely collapse as soon as they started to question her.
"But I don't even know where this is,"
she countered, trying to convince herself that after all the things she'd already had to go through in her short and miserable life, torture couldn't be that much worse. But knowing deep down, of course, that it would be.
"We could be anywhere."
"You know it's underground. You know the color of these stones. That would be enough for a smart man."
"What are you saying?"
Evie shouted, close to losing all control.
"That I have to stay here forever?"
"Only until I'm done," V replied, trying to calm her down again. "After the fifth, I no longer think it will matter."
"The fifth?"
she said, puzzled for a moment, until she realized what he was talking about.
You mean a year from now? I have to stay here for a year.
I'm sorry, Evie, he told her, suddenly seeming deflated in the face of her angry rejection. I just didn't know what else to do.
You should have left me alone,
she yelled, losing it at last, yet knowing even as she screamed at him that she didn't really mean it, knowing he had no other choice.
Why didn't you just leave me alone?
Then, with tears blurring her vision and streaming down her face, Evie spun around and dashed from the room, back along the passage to the bedroom, which it seemed she was now going to have to think of as home, because it was either that or think of it as a prison, and she had no other home to go to now, or perhaps forevermore. And we, surrounded by all the treasures of the past, all those things that made a solitary life worthwhile, could only stand and listen as the stillness of the night was rent by painful, uncomprehending sobs, and know that Evie Hammond's wasn't the only life that had changed forever. Windowless as the shadow gallery was, the only indication of the coming morning was that the lights had been turned up a little more brightly, and the smell of frying eggs. It was the eggs rather than the light that woke Evie, though if truth were told, she hadn't slept much at all anyway, and crying herself to sleep was one of those things that she'd hoped was long behind her now. Still, no matter how much pain or grief the heart and mind might bear, the stomach always has demands quite independent of its own, and Evie had always been prepared to get up for fried eggs. In the Shadow Gallery's kitchen, V was smiling to himself beneath the mask, preparing what the Americans had called eggs in a basket, though in the part of England where he'd come from, they were always called an Egyptian fish-eye sandwich. Quite why, he never knew, but he treasured the picturesque name as another fine survival from the past. Evie found him standing at the stove, the eggs starting to sizzle in the middle of the toasted bread before him, masked and dressed pretty much as usual, except for the cloak, and an apron tied around his waist, which she found at once both ridiculous and touchingly homely. A mother and a father figure, both combined. "V," she asked tentatively, not really certain how his mood would be after their contretemps the night before. "Oh, good morning," he said pleasantly enough, turning round and holding the pan and spatula away from the stove a moment while he talked.
"I just wanted to apologize for my reaction last night," Evie said nervously, trying not to stumble over the speech she'd been rehearsing every time she'd woken up in the latter part of the night. "I understand what you did for me, and I want you to know that I'm grateful."
And then the words just tailed off, and refused to say themselves any more as she looked, appalled, at his hands. For V, too busy with his cooking, had neglected to put on his gloves. The skin of both hands was horribly scarred, as if from severe burn damage, and that not treated very well besides. What was left of the flesh was healed over now, but the resemblance to normal skin was marginal at best.
"Your hands?"
Evie questioned softly, but there didn't seem to be anything else to add. "Oh, yes," said V, quickly putting down the pan and grabbing his gloves from the kitchen counter nearby, turning away from her and hiding his hands as he pulled them on. "There," he said a moment later, turning back toward her. "That's better. I hope I didn't spoil your appetite."
"No, please,"
Evie put in quickly, suddenly filled with a sympathy that the previous day she'd never have thought to feel for this strange and baffling man, whose unrevealing reserve disguised almost as much as his mask.
"It's just... are you all right?"
"It's fine," he told her briefly, but by no means abruptly. "Fine."
"Can I ask what happened?"
He turned his attention back to the eggs. "There was a fire." V raised his head as if looking off into the distant past. "A long time ago. Ancient history, for some. Not really very good table conversation." And then, with little more than a mental shrug, he glanced round toward her, changing the subject. "Would you care for a cup of tea and some eggs?"
"Yes, thank you,"
she said eagerly, as if she thought he'd never ask.
"I'm starving, actually."
With that he nodded toward a small breakfast table and skilfully slid the eggs out of the pan onto a plate, picked up a knife and fork, and turned to set the simple feast before her. "Please, enjoy," he said, adding, after the slightest of pauses, "I've already eaten." "Of course," she thought. To eat in her company would require taking off the mask, and there might be more than simple reasons of identification for avoiding that. And if his face was anything like his hands, did she really want to know what he looked like? But by then the eggs were hot in her mouth, and there was something else to think about apart from other people's features.
"Mmm, delicious,"
she sighed softly, mouth full and already forking up some more.
"Good,"
he remarked, with all the satisfaction of a chef who just served up an 8-course banquet.
"Oh, God!"
said Evie suddenly, recognition dawning of a long-forgotten taste and bringing back a flood of memories.
"I haven't had real butter since I was a little girl. Where on earth did you get it from?"
"A government supply train." V's voice betrayed the smirk that obviously played about his lips. "It was on its way to Chancellor Sattler."
"You stole it from Chancellor Sattler?"
Evie spluttered, almost choking on a bit of egg. Was there anything he wouldn't risk?
"You're insane!"
"I dare do all that may become a man," V quoted at her sententiously. "Who dares do more is none."
"Macbeth,"
Evie tossed back at him, determined not to be outdone. "Very good," said V, casting a glance out into the shadow gallery toward his favourite bust, then nodding his head a little bit to indicate a query.
"My mum," she explained, finishing off the eggs. "She used to read his plays to me, and ever since then I've always wanted to act, be in plays or movies. When I was 9, I played viola in Twelfth Night. Mum was very proud."
A little smile played, unbidden, round her lips. Memories as sweet as that were few and far between. "And where is your mother now?"
"She's dead."
"I'm sorry." Evie nodded, well used to receiving this kind of sympathy. But then she was hardly alone in that. She couldn't think of anyone she knew who hadn't been touched by this sort of loss somewhere among their family or friends. She took a mouthful of tea, and they sat there for a moment, looking at each other across the table in silence, wondering what other secrets might still remain. Everyone, she knew, wore masks of one kind or another. It was just that V's was far more obvious than most.
"Can I ask you about what you said on the telly?"
she said at length, although she wasn't really sure she wanted to go back over the previous day's events. But if she was going to have to live here, and with him, for a whole year, she needed to know what was going on, what made him tick.
"Did you mean it?"
"Every word."
"Do you really think blowing up the Houses of Parliament is going to make this country a better place?"
"There is no certainty, only opportunity." Aphorisms and quotations. They seemed to make up half his conversation, Evie thought. Maybe even more. Sometimes she was impressed, though probably not as impressed as he thought she ought to be. At other times she just found it downright annoying. Was he really just a know-all with a photographic memory? Or was his manner of speaking just another mask, to hide his real self? Or was he, as had occurred to her on the first night they'd met, actually some sort of lunatic? Well, the only way to find out about that real self would be to keep him talking and to listen to the bits that weren't just learned recitation.
"I think you can be pretty certain that if anyone does show up to join in," she said a moment later, "Creedy will blackbag every one of them."
"People should not be afraid of their government," he said, slipping back into his teaching mode. "Governments should be afraid of their people."
"And you're going to make that happen by blowing up a building?"
she asked, rising to the challenge now. "The building is a symbol," said the man whose face was nothing more than that besides, "as is the act of destroying it. Symbols are given power by people. Alone a symbol is meaningless, but with enough people involved as well, blowing up a building can change the world."
"I wish I believed that was possible."
Evie put down the empty teacup.
"I really do. But every time I've seen this world change, it's always been for the worse."
She stood up then, adding,
"Thanks for the eggs."
And with that she walked away and headed back to her room, leaving V still sitting there at the table, the expression on his mask as enigmatic as ever.
"Right there. What's he thinking?"
asked Chief Inspector Finch, more to himself than Dominic, even though the younger man sat there right beside him. Both of them were staring intently at a small monitor showing security camera footage from the Jordan Tower fiasco of the previous day, from one of the few cameras that the terrorist had somehow neglected to disable on his way in. Looking with total concentration at V, standing contemplatively over the unconscious bodies of Evie and Dominic, sprawling at his feet.
Is he considering leaving her? After she just saved him?
"He's a terrorist. You can't expect him to act like you or me," Dominic said shortly, still red-eyed and raising a hand to feel the bruising at the back of his neck. Understanding the man wasn't his major priority at the moment, just catching him. Catching him and getting him alone in a cell where he could kick 9 kinds of living shit out of the bastard. And as for the girl, well, Dominic wasn't the kind who'd normally go around beating up women, but for women with pepper sprays he was prepared to make an exception. On the monitor, V finally bent down and scooped Evie up in his arms.
"Some part of him is human," Finch pointed out. "And for better or worse, she's stuck with him."
Watching V carry Evie to the elevator one more time, and he couldn't remember how many times he'd watched the masked man do the same before, Finch finally turned the monitor off and swiveled his chair round to face Dominic, noticing the folder his assistant had brought when he'd come over to join him.
"You got anything else on her parents?"
"Yeah." Dominic spread papers on the desk. "And it's not good. They were both interned at Belmarsh."
"Oh, no," groaned Finch.
The same old story again. How many thousands had disappeared? Good people, for the most part, he was sure, just because they'd disagreed with the party policy line, or protested at the takeover. How many families had been broken up while they were establishing the new order? Still, they'd been worse places than Belmarsh, he knew. Belmarsh was just where they took the politicals. There'd been other, fouler hells during the reclamation, for the degenerates, the immigrants, the heretics, and all the other labels they'd used to dehumanize the victims. How easy it was to forget that one was dealing with real people when they just became categories, to be sorted, filed, and then forgotten when they'd been removed from the records. It was still going on to this day. After all, nobody in the media or the government news releases spoke of this V as a man, as someone who might have feelings, a family, a history. He was just the terrorist. Of course, of all the categories who'd been dealt with in the reclamation, it had been the politicals who'd been the most troublesome, who'd put up the most resistance. "Yeah," Dominic continued, a little more sympathy in his voice now that the subject had changed away from his particular bête noire and back to Eva's parents. "She died during the hunger strike, and he copped it when the military retook the shed."
"That's terrible."
"That's not the worst of it. Her brother was at St. Mary's."
"Christ."
"Nothing but bad luck there," the younger man concluded, with a shrug that implied, "But what could anyone do?"
"So, we know her story. Now we need his."
7. To say that Lewis Prothero had an apartment worthy of a man in his position would be something of an understatement. The penthouse overlooking the Thames was more of a monument to a man in his position. Or, more to the point, a cathedral raised entirely in celebration of its owner. "Lewis Prothero is God," it said. "There is no other God but he. And this is where Lewis Prothero retires at night, for worship of himself." The large and lavish bathroom reflected this no less than any of the other rooms. Indeed, right then it reflected nothing but Lewis Prothero, for his face and robed figure were to be seen looking back from gleaming mirrors all around the room. And where there were no mirrors, monitors projected from the walls instead, each screen wired back to a central video unit that was repeating the evening's earlier Voice of London broadcast on a continuous loop. Somehow, then, the bathroom became a vast kaleidoscope, combining past and present, audio and visual, a myriad starry aspects of the divine Lewis Prothero, too wonderful for simple words ever to quite express. What more could a man wish to contemplate, stripped naked and leaving behind all the dross of the everyday world, than himself, the star and marvel of his age? And what better voice to provide accompaniment to his own than, again, his own?
"I'll tell you what I know," the Prothero of the Monitor was shouting to the London mob,
and Prothero of the Bathroom joined in.
"I know this is not a man!"
The broadcast was, naturally, about that stupid terrorist who'd almost managed to blow up the studio, almost taken the great Lewis Prothero off the air. A mask-wearing clown, he thought. That's all he was.
"A man does not wear a mask!" cried television Prothero,
as his living counterpart flipped open a mirrored cabinet to reveal row upon row of prescription medicine bottles, for none of which he had any legal prescription at all.
"What is he?"
cried Prothero, sorting out his drug list for the evening.
"A man does not threaten innocent civilians," the tape continued. "What is he?"
Prothero threw back the feed line again, now with better timing.
"I'll tell you what he is,"
the Monitor responded with precision.
"What every gutless, freedom-hating terrorist is, a goddamned coward!"
Strange how they always wrote that line for him to say, he thought, even when he was talking about suicide bombers, who dared far more than even he, the heroic Lewis Prothero, would do. After all, he might say whatever was necessary in defence of what he believed in, but to actually die for it? No, thank you very much. He was officer class, and they had cannon fodder for that sort of thing. Still, calling other people cowards had never affected his ratings, and those were far more important than anything else. As the audience broke out into spontaneous applause, just as they always did, Prothero paused to gobble a handful of pills, chasing down the cocktail with half a tumbler of scotch. Ah, yes. That should do it. Before he could take another swig, the phone began to ring. Using the remote to pause the tape, Prothero picked up the handset and listened for a moment. That prancing, self-important little piece of shit, Roger Dascombe. Just because Dascombe attended cabinet meetings, and that was unjust in itself, it was quite obvious that Prothero himself was the only person fit to talk to Sutler on behalf of the mouth. No, actually he should be telling Sutler what to do, not receiving instructions from on high. And just because he dressed up like a nonce, and what was this drivel he was talking about now? Oh, that again.
"There will be no negotiation, Roger," he said flatly, disregarding that Dascombe was nominally his boss. "When I come in tomorrow, the paddy will be gone. I'm looking at the tape right now, and he has no idea how to light me. My nose looks like Big Fucking Ben."
Dascombe began to whine, but Prothero was no longer listening, instead carefully checking his nose in the mirror against the one on the monitor. Definitely the thick Irishman's fault.
"Listen to me, you bleeding sod," Prothero cut in. "England prevails because I say it does, and every lazy sod on this show is there because I say he is, and that includes you. Find another director of photography, or find yourself another job."
That told him, Prothero thought, clicking off the phone. Then, picking up the remote and setting the Voice of London rolling again, he headed for the shower. Dascombe. The terrorist.
Everybody. Fuck them all. "I'll tell you what I wish," the taped voice came again, more brash, more bully-boyish by the moment, as Prothero turned on the faucet. "I wish I'd been there. I wish I'd had the chance for a face-to-face. Just one chance, that's all I'd need."
And as the shower began to stream, down in the lobby, the elevator doors opened, with a faint mechanical ding, while a black-gloved hand swiped an ID through the security panel. An ID with a familiar name and face, though not the one belonging to the hand. Evie Hammonds. Prothero, of course, knew none of this, sluicing down his well-rounded form in the enormous shower, while watching none other than himself upon a waterproof monitor, placed there specially for the purpose.
"This so-called V," his voice re-echoed, along with his accomplice, Evie Hammond, neo-demagogues spouting their message of hate.
Nice delivery, that, he thought, as clouds of thick steam rose around him, coagulating like ectoplasm. But Prothero was wrapped up in far more than that by now. He was wrapped up in himself.
"A delusional and aberrant voice," said his television self. "Aberrant and abhorrent," he chimed in, embroidering on the theme. Ought to be writing his own scripts, obviously, as well as doing everything else. "Delivering a terrorist's ultimatum!" "Treason!" cried Prothero, taking the audience's part, responding to himself. "An ultimatum that was met with swift, surgically precise justice. No mercy!" "And the moral of this story, ladies and gentlemen?" his electronic persona asked, dropping now into a calm, reassuring voice that sought to put all the troubles of the past few days behind them. Prothero, smiling and winking to his own reflection as he stepped out of the shower, didn't wait for the recording, but delivered the punchline on his own. "Good guys win, bad guys lose, and, as always, England prevails." And as the tape re-echoed that triumphant declaration, he clicked off the monitors, watching that much-loved image of himself fade to grey. And saw another face, reflected in their glass, and in the mirrors. A bone-white smile, a fixed, mustachioed grin, hideous in its implication. A mask. Partly shaded beneath a broad-brim hat, mounted on black-caped shoulders, a combination of the Puritan and the Joker, an image of the grinning knight. A 17th-century incarnation of the Grim Reaper come back to haunt the 21st. V.
"Holy Christ!"
cried Prothero, half a shout of terror, half a gasp of despair. As he spun round to face the intruder, his foot slipped on the slick marble floor. His legs collapsed, and all those extra pounds of flesh accrued through years of increasingly good living slapped down wetly at V's feet. He lay there for an instant, gasping for breath like a beached whale as the sobering adrenaline pumped through his veins, then looked up, terrified at his uninvited, most unwelcome guest.
"Good evening, Commander Prothero," said V calmly, though rather less than pleasantly, looking down at him as if he were some pinned and wriggling insect awaiting examination, or dissection.
"Oh my God!" groaned Prothero,
suddenly and desperately hoping that there might be another deity beside himself.
"How did you get in here?"
Disdaining to reply, V seemed to be giving him a moment to recover from his panic before commencing with the evening's entertainment. And Prothero, still looking to retain some scrap of dignity despite his terror, took advantage of the pause to scramble away and grab a bath towel. The phone on which he'd been speaking to Dascombe earlier, however, seemed too far away to reach.
"Don't worry," V told him, following the direction of his glance. "I've made sure our reunion won't be disturbed by any annoying late-night phone calls, Commander."
"Stop that!"
snapped Prothero, annoyance mingling with his confusion. And something a little more than annoyance.
"Why do you keep calling me that?"
"That was your title, remember?"
V stepped closer, looming over him like the shadow of impending death.
"When we first met? All those years ago?"
Cooling droplets of shower water now began to mingle on Prothero's quaking flesh with even colder sweat.
"You wore a uniform in those days," said V, a sudden hardness edging his voice. "You looked very good in it."
And then the images began to come back. Not video footage this time, no one saw any footage from those days anymore, but memories, emerging from their long-suppressed hiding place in Prothero's dank and rank unconscious. Lark Hill Resettlement Camp. Latest in a long line of venerable institutions. After all, the very concept of the concentration camp was a British invention, dating back to the Boer War, picked up by others, with enthusiasm. Auschwitz, Dachau, the Gulags, Guantanamo Bay, Lark Hill. Not that anyone called them concentration camps after the Second World War, of course. They were detention centres, or resettlement camps. Different names. Same nasty institutions.
the razor-wire fences, the watchtowers and searchlights, the brutes in boots with the soulless faces and the automatic weapons, the doctors with the scalpels not bothering with anaesthetics. The wire cages, where the naked prisoners huddled together, regardless of their sex or age, don't call them human beings, don't even bother with their names, the numbers forcibly tattooed upon their skins were surely quite enough, unwashed and wallowing in their own filth, and praying to their varied gods. Not the god, for, as everybody knew, the true god was an Englishman, and had no time for Johnny Foreigner. The punishment beatings, the sexual abuse and humiliations, the photographs to laugh over in the officers' mess afterward, the torture rooms, the executions, the cremation ovens. And, yes, the human skin lampshades that one of the guards had made, a joke, he said, to keep up the old traditions. Besides, anything Herman the German could do, be sure that Tommy Atkins could do far better. Of course, the man had been disciplined for that, but all that meant was transfer to another camp, where he probably did the same sort of thing all over again. Being a psychopathic sadist wasn't the problem. Quite the reverse. As they always used to joke in the mess, with the jobs they did, camp guards needed to be more than a touch pathological to stay sane. It was just that this one had got a mite frolicsome. And there, bestriding his world like a colossus, his little hell on earth and kingdom of his own, Commander Lewis Protheroe. So fine in his perfectly tailored uniform, and tailored then to fit a rather leaner and more muscular body, the sort the ladies liked, or so he told himself, but perhaps it was just the power. His mirror-polished boots, his horsewhip, his first delusions of grandeur, delusory in that his notions of his own grandeur had simply been far too humiliatingly modest, before he rose to the godhead that only television could bestow. Strolling along the blood-stained and ceramic-tiled floors in that special block, the one that only the top brass were shown, but only after the floors had been sluiced clean so he didn't soil his boots. The cells where the experiments were, or at least the ones who'd survived the ordinary horrors of the medical block. The experiments. One particular experiment.
"You?"
gasped Protheroe, terror almost freezing the word upon his lips. A final image, then, from when it had all come to an end, a faceless silhouette against a howling inferno of flame, stalking his nightmares to a soundtrack of explosions and screaming men, the heart of the darkness that had haunted him ever since. The horror. The horror.
"It is you," said Protheroe flatly, finally, knowing there was nothing more to be done and nothing more to say.
Not wet ceramic tiles beneath him now, but marble. Not blood-stained. Yet.
"The ghost of Christmas past," said the voice behind the mask.
And then the figure stepped forward, became silhouetted against the bathroom lights, became as black as death itself. Across town in Lambeth, south of the Thames, a phone began to ring in a night-darkened apartment. Nothing here of the overblown grandeur of Protheroe's place. This was a small studio flat suited to a man living alone, a man who'd lost his family long ago and whose existence, as a consequence, was little more now than work. With his salary, the occupant could have afforded something better, but all he really needed was a place to sleep that was close enough, when the fuel shortages got bad, for him to leave the car behind and walk to work. Or at least a place to sleep when he was allowed to. Some time passed before the figure in the bedroom stirred, fumbling in the dark and cursing under his breath, then finally flipped on the light and reached out for the handset.
"Yeah," said Eric Finch, barely awake, eyes half open, completely unaware of the time but knowing that this was not the time for routine calls.
"Finch!"
a panic-stricken voice bleated in his ear.
"It's Dascom!"
"Dascom?" queried Finch, uncomprehendingly. Why was that slimy little prat phoning him in the middle of the night?
"What?"
"I've already called the Chancellor,"
Dascom cut in hurriedly, almost tripping over himself in his desperate urgency to get the words out.
"We have to get control of the situation."
Finch couldn't figure this out at all. He had no idea what Dascom was talking about. And more than that, he'd never heard him in such a state before. Rubbing the sleep from his eyes with a knuckle, he asked,
"What situation?"
Half an hour later, and still waiting for forensics to arrive, Finch and Dascombe stood side by side in Prothero's bathroom, looking down at the former star's lifeless, naked body. Cold and paling as the blood, no longer pumping against the pull of gravity, sank down toward the floor, his was a two-tone corpse, white above and pink beneath. No knife wounds on this corpse to let the blood escape, no messy human meat exposed to view. A clean death, as far as murders ever went. By the body sat a single floribunda rose, petals open in full bloom, salmon pink, but blending into cream and yellow. And looking round the gilded palace of sin that was Lewis Prothero's bathroom, Finch was sure as hell that the man who'd been the Voice of London wasn't the type to put it there. Jesus Christ! What sort of life was the man living anyway? The bathroom was bad enough, but the other rooms—
"Chancellor Sattler agreed for obvious reasons," Dascombe cut across his train of thought, "that we have to keep this discreet, Inspector. Cast in the wrong light, the loss of the Voice of London could be devastating to our credibility, you understand?"
Finch understood all right. No thought of the man who was dead, of the man who'd killed him, or of bringing the murderer to justice. Bloody media people. Let's just cover our asses and get out of this mess with our jobs and pay packets and status still intact. Looking good and smelling of roses, like the one here on the floor. Unfeeling bastard. Roses. This one obviously had some significance, though right now Finch had no idea what. He knelt down to look at it more closely. Not a familiar colour. But then flowers weren't his forte anyway. He'd need to find someone who could tell him more about it.
"Perhaps a stroke?" Dascombe continued,
merely thinking aloud now, as he realized that Finch wasn't going to give him any audience feedback. No, no, too horrific. A quiet, dignified death in his sleep. Not that there was anything dignified about being poisoned, Finch thought, glancing back at the green foam that had bubbled from Prothero's nose and mouth, at the empty eyes staring fixedly at the ceiling. No mirrors up there, Finch thought. But then Prothero obviously never thought he'd end up lying on his back, with poison eating into his nerves and brain, unable to see himself in the last few seconds before he was unable to see anything at all. With that green gunk coming out of his nostrils, he probably wouldn't have wanted to see himself anyway. Footsteps clicking on the marble floor attracted Finch's attention. He looked up to see Dominic enter the room, paused to glance around, a little bleary-eyed, in bewildered disbelief at the sybaritic luxury all around, then come over to join him. He, too, looked down at the body for a moment. Not a pretty sight. But young in the service as he was, he'd quickly become used to seeing a large variety of corpses, especially in days like these.
"Got any eyes or ears on this one?" Finch asked him, rising once again to his feet.
"Camcos were cut," Dominic replied. "Same M.O. as before, but we've got an elevator log ID."
"Let me guess," Finch remarked wearily, already knowing the answer as well as his assistant.
"She's in deep, Inspector," Dominic confirmed.
8. Terror. The old terror, the one she tried to suppress, the one she hated to think about and mostly didn't dare, the one where she woke shortly before dawn, and heard. Was she back there now? Was the old terror repeating itself? Or was this a new one? Whatever it was, Evie woke to the sound of a violent struggle, as she'd done so long ago. And that wasn't the only terrifying part. The pre-dawn violence was bad enough, but it was always, she knew, the precursor to a chain of events that grew more terrible still. But surely that couldn't be happening here. Not again. Not here in V's underground home. Not unless... unless someone had discovered the location of the shadow gallery.
"V?"
she called quietly, hardly daring to shout in case it gave her position away. The noise continued. But then she realized there'd been nothing like the barking report of gunfire. Only the clash of metal, the sound of stamping feet and shouting. Slightly reassured, but still nervous, Evie tumbled out of bed, hastily pulled on a robe, and then silently and cautiously made her way along the passage to the shadow gallery's poster-littered living area. Creeping into a gloomy corner of the hall, she looked, and felt her jaw drop in astonishment. for there was V, his cloak thrown back over his shoulders, wielding a rapier in one hand, leaping and stamping as if in a deadly duel, cutting, parrying, and lunging toward a hopelessly overmatched opponent, a stationary suit of armour. Had he gone completely mad? The previous day she'd thought him dangerous, but that sort of threat receded into nothingness compared with this completely uncontrolled behaviour. But then she realized that, actually, he wasn't entirely alone, or at least not entirely unaccompanied. On a television set behind him, an old black-and-white movie was playing, a swashbuckler that looked as if it went back to the 1930s, with a dashing hero also fencing for his life and more besides, for love. And V was mimicking all the hero's moves in perfect synchronization, and speaking his lines as well, words he quite obviously knew by heart. With a last flurry of clicking, metallic blows, he finally vanquished the helpless suit of armour and sent its helmet crashing to the floor. Evie could only smile to herself at the complete and absolute commitment of his lunacy. As the echoes of the tumbled helmet eventually faded into silence, he realized he was being watched. "Oh," said V quietly, quickly adjusting his mask, though whether that was to make sure his identity or his embarrassment was covered, she couldn't tell. "I'm sorry," he continued. "I hope I didn't wake you."
"No," she told him, though that wasn't quite the truth. "I just thought you were fighting. I mean, fighting for real."
Whether there was concern in her words for him, for herself, or for the both of them, was something neither of them could quite decide. Leaving the question hanging, V turned and gestured toward the TV set, using the rapier to do so. "It's my favourite film, The Count of Monte Cristo, with Robert Donat as Edmond Dantes. It gets me every time."
"I've never seen it."
After all, it must have been made at least 50 years before Evie was even born, and now that there were far fewer TV channels than when she was a little girl, it wasn't surprising she hadn't come across it. "Really?" asked V. Then, with a rather charming eagerness, "Would you like to?"
"Does it have a happy ending?"
she asked tentatively, feeling somehow that, after all she'd been through in the last few days, happy endings were now the most important things in the world. "The Count finally finds peace in the arms of the beautiful Mercedes," he assured her.
"A happy ending?"
she asked again, still not quite certain what finding peace might imply. "As only celluloid can deliver."
"Okay,"
she said, smiling with just a little relief. Then, looking at what he still held in his hand and remembering how carried away he'd been a few moments before, she added,
"But put the sword away."
Finch had returned to his desk at New Scotland Yard and begun to drain a steady succession of coffee cups. He ought to be used to losing sleep after all these years on the force, but on balance the older he got, the harder it got to take. And in spite of the continuing law-and-order clampdown by Creedy and his goons, the sort of crime that ordinary coppers had to deal with didn't seem to be going down at all. The more you took away the things that were important in people's lives, he guessed, such as liberty and freedom of movement, the more desperate they became. And desperate people didn't worry about what was right or wrong, only what they could get away with. He looked up, then, from the computer monitor where facts and figures were blurring into meaningless symbols before his aching eyes, as Dominic came into the office flicking through a sheaf of printouts. "Forensics just wrapped things up," the young detective told him. "No prints, no hair, no fibres. The guy's like a ghost. But you wouldn't believe the shit they found in Prothero."
"Drugs?"
"Could have started his own hospital."
"Interesting."
Finch beckoned him over.
"Why?"
asked Dominic, coming round to join him behind the desk. Finch indicated the monitor, where the meaningless symbols he'd been looking at a moment earlier now began to make a little more sense.
"Did you know that Lewis Prothero was one of the richest men in the country, before he became the Voice of London?"
"Drugs?"
Dominic's eyes lit up, as they always did when there was even the slightest hint of a hot lead.
"Legal ones," Finch said. "A major stockholder in Viadox Pharmaceutical."
"Wow!"
breathed Dominic, as the link snapped into place.
"Viadox and St. Mary's in less than a week. Coincidence?"
Finch shook his head, the faintest of smiles upon his face. His usual reaction to a hot lead.
When you've been at this as long as I have, you've stopped believing in them.
In the black-and-white world of the TV screen, which had somehow had all the colour of magic to Evie for a couple of hours, the final romantic swell of music was coming up, with Edmond Dantès, the Count of Monte Cristo himself, nestled in the Tree of Happiness with Mercedes de Rosas. "Find your own tree," he addressed the final remark to the viewer, and as the end came up, Evie could only sniff. They certainly didn't make them like that any more, and she didn't care if that was a cliché.
"Did you like it?" asked V, looking round for the remote.
"Yeah."
To simply sit in safety on a comfortable couch and watch a movie after the last few days that she'd been having was a pleasure in itself.
But it made me feel sorry for Mercedes.
Why?
Because he cared more about revenge than he did about her.
V nodded, as if this was an acceptable female point of view, but not one that carried a great deal of weight with him, and clicked off the DVD player. BTN's regular news programming reappeared on the screen. And June, far more serious than usual, though it had to be admitted that in the last few days serious-faced newsreaders were becoming more and more the norm, was making yet another grave announcement.
"Fans nationwide have been devastated as news of the most popular—"
V started to reach out to turn off the set, but Evie put a hand on his arm.
"Wait, what's this? Most awarded stars in the history of the BTN," continued the familiar face and voice. "A man known to the entire nation as the Voice of London passed away late last night from apparent heart failure."
A black, bordered photo of Lewis Prothero appeared next on the screen.
"She's lying,"
Evie said flatly, her conviction absolute. "How do you know?" asked V, though obviously he knew well enough that she was.
"She always blinks a lot when she does a story that she knows is false,"
Evie told him softly, still trying to concentrate on the words of the announcement.
"An extraordinary talent, he had dedicated his life to his country and his beliefs, working tirelessly at his profession. It came as no surprise to those who knew him that his body was found at his office, where he often worked long hours after everyone else had gone home. Lewis, you will be sorely missed."
Evie could feel her hackles rising as V reached out to turn off the television. Something about all this just didn't seem right. So many things had happened in the last few days, and she couldn't quite put her finger on how they connected up. Except that, she began to suspect, they all linked back to V. And then she became aware that he was silently watching her, the mask's expression as unreadable as ever.
"V,"
she began hesitantly, hardly wanting to bring up the subject, as she didn't know where it would lead.
"Yesterday, I couldn't find my ID."
Still he sat there, regarding her in enigmatic silence.
"You didn't take it, did you?"
she asked nervously, dreading the answer as soon as she asked the question. She found she couldn't quite sit still, and the couch that had seemed so comfortable a few minutes before was starting to feel more like a bed of nails. "Would you prefer a lie or the truth?" he asked her in a neutral voice, suggestive of nothing but making the answer absolutely clear.
"Oh, my God!"
gasped Evie, jumping up from the couch and staring down at him in shocked disbelief.
"Did you have anything to do with that?"
A gesture toward the TV set made it quite plain what the "that" she was referring to was. "Yes," he told her calmly. "I killed him."
"You—"
Evie didn't believe she was hearing this, yet at the same time she knew she had to believe she was.
"Oh, God!"
"You're upset,"
V quite plainly stated the obvious, one of those facile pieces of phrasing that suggested he thought that acknowledging she was upset might somehow calm her down. Unfortunately, it had quite the opposite effect.
"I'm upset!"
she cried, trying to fight down a growing sense of near-hysterical panic.
"You just said you killed Lewis Prothero! Lewis Prothero!"
"I might have killed the fingermen that attacked you, too." He inclined his head in what she'd come to recognize as a gesture of inquiry. Usually uncomfortable inquiry. "But did I hear any objection then?"
"What?"
She almost choked on the word, suddenly taken aback. Why was he suddenly changing the subject?
Or was he changing the subject? Violence can be used for a higher purpose. Here it came again, that sense of being tutored in unpleasant truths. She took a couple of paces backward, suddenly nervous.
What are you talking about?
Justice.
Oh.
Evie paused as she thought of the movie they'd just watched, of the injustice done to Edmond Dantès, of the illegal imprisonment in the Château d'If, and although she had no liking for the principle of revenge, of the admittedly justified payback his enemies had finally received, and how, in the end, yes, she had thought there was a happy ending.
I see.
She breathed softly, understanding but still wishing to sound non-committal. At times V's view of the world was just too raw and uncompromising, too hard for her to take. There is no court in this country for men like Prothero, V told her, though he didn't actually tell her what the crime had been that merited such final and fatal retribution.
Are you going to—
A pause. A deep breath, a question she didn't really want to ask.
Kill more people?
It hardly seemed necessary to answer, but he nodded anyway.
Are you going to kill me?
The question just slipped out. Of course not, Evie. He rose to his feet and started toward her, almost as if he wanted to take her in his arms and reassure her. But then, of course, he would say that, whether he intended to or not.
No, don't!
She said, backing off a pace to match the one he'd taken toward her. Then, turning away in a gesture that effectively ended the conversation, she said,
I think I should go back to my room now.
Finch, meanwhile, hadn't left his room at all, hadn't left his desk, hadn't left that same screen where he was dredging through the nose's data retrieval system. Take a look at this, he said, summoning Dominic, who'd been doing much the same. Prothero's military record. What do you see? Dominic leaned forward, squinting at the screen. Iraq, Kurdistan, Syria before and after, Sudan. Busy boy. Yeah. Finch swigged coffee. But after all that, they put him in charge of a detention facility at Larkhill. No good deed goes unpunished, put in Dominic contemplatively. Right, agreed Finch, though he silently added to himself, or bad deed unrewarded. Though he found it hard to think what the reward might have been in a place like Larkhill. Maybe Dominic was right. Maybe it was some misdemeanor that had got Prothero sent there. But that wasn't what his instincts said. So maybe Larkhill had been more important than it first appeared.
You think there's a connection between Larkhill and our boy?
Asked Dominic, after a few seconds' thought. It might explain the connection between him and the Hammond girl, Finch replied. Though he recalled that the girl's parents had been sent to Belmarsh rather than Larkhill. Still, detention camps were detention camps, and maybe it wasn't the camps that were the connection. It was Viadox who'd come up with a cure for the St. Mary's virus, and Prothero was a major shareholder in Viadox, and in charge of Larkhill. And V had killed Prothero. No, it all went round in circles, somehow, and didn't quite add up. But the name Larkhill was eating into his gut now, and he knew he was going to have to find out more. Such a pleasant-sounding name, redolent of birdsong and woodland and rolling English countryside. But then people probably used to think that Belsen was a nice place name, before they built a concentration camp there. Larkhill. Problem is, he added, I can't find any other record of the place. They looked at each other for a few seconds, but, as Finch had suspected all along, Dominic didn't surprise him with a brilliant idea. Instead, the expression on his face just said, "What do we do next?" Sometimes the boy was such a disappointment, thought Finch ruefully, smiling slightly to himself. But no, that wasn't really true. He had no more right to expect Dominic to suddenly solve things for him than he did the Almighty. And in the last 40 years the Almighty hadn't come through once. Yet. It was just that, unfortunately, Finch knew exactly what they had to do next, and he was absolutely sure it was going to be absolutely futile. But they had to go through the procedures anyway. Sighing,
He got slowly to his feet and started toward the door, gesturing for the young man to follow. At least the journey he had in mind probably wouldn't take long enough to give Dominic time to kill them. A couple of hours later, Finch's frustration was starting to approach boiling point. He'd had quite enough of dead ends and stonewalling, as he'd also had enough of traipsing along what seemed to be endless miles of corridor on his redirected way from one filing clerk to another. And now here he was, sitting in an office at the Department of Military Records in the Ministry of Defence, the office of, he'd been told, the man who'd been there, the man in charge, who'd be just the blighter to sort out the problem for him. Fat fucking chance. Major Wilson had some of that same military pomposity that the unlamented Lewis Prothero had had, though he still had the form and style to carry it off convincingly. An officer and a gentleman. Sitting there behind his desk with his back ramrod straight, and probably all the straighter in response to Finch's battered, weary slouch, he obviously had no time for civilian interference. Damnation! If this was what a career policeman looked like, he'd show him what it was like to go up against a career military man. Damned nosy bastard, anyway. And the boy with him looked as if he could do with 6 months' worth of square bashing to knock him into shape. Young puppy had actually had the damn nerve to ask him a direct question a couple of minutes ago. Shouldn't be allowed.
Larkhill? Wilson queried, military bluster mingling with an apparent desire to help as Finch brought up the name yet again. Larkhill? I don't recall that particular facility, Inspector. But of course you're welcome to review our records.
We've been through your records, Major, Finch said through gritted teeth, struggling with no great success to maintain a dignified calm. All they say is that there was a detention facility at Larkhill, approximately 10 miles north of Salisbury.
Well then, there you have it, Wilson said smugly.
That'd show these civilian johnnies. Military records, absolutely reliable. At New Scotland Yard they probably couldn't tell the difference between a criminal record and a laundry list, if they could find either. Finch sighed and rubbed his forehead wearily, looking up at Wilson's completely false but oh so helpful, oh so condescending smile. And the bastard hadn't even offered them a cup of coffee.
"This is a matter of some urgency, Major Wilson," he said with exaggerated patience, determined that he wasn't going to fall into that old English routine where, if someone didn't seem to understand what you were saying, you simply repeated it louder and louder until he did. "We need to know if there was anything different about this facility." "I'm sorry, Inspector," came the supercilious reply, "but I really cannot remember."
"Was there a specific profile for those being sent there?" Finch probed doggedly, exasperatedly.
"Usual undesirable, I should think."
"But do you know?"
"Of course not,"
snapped Wilson, his own patience starting to wear thin. A breath to regain his composure. Couldn't let these damned civilians get under his skin.
"I wasn't stationed there myself."
"Do you know who was?" Like a dog worrying a bone, Finch wouldn't let it go.
"I cannot recall any specific names," Wilson stonewalled again, "but if you look through our records—"
"Your records are either deleted, omitted, or missing," growled Finch, voice rising, patience finally exhausted.
"As you were the head of the detention program at that time—"
"Before you go any further, Inspector," Wilson barked back, face starting to flush with anger,
"let me remind you that things were very chaotic back then."
Finch groaned inwardly, while Dominic looked on in helpless frustration. How many times had they heard that line already this morning?
"Right now we don't have the problems we had back then," Wilson continued flatly. "We all did what we had to do, and under the circumstances we did the best we could."
Then, finally, shortly, and in the act of rising to his feet, "And that's all I have to say about that." A couple of paces round the desk, a hand gesturing toward the door, a tight-lipped expression, and silence. That really was all that Wilson had to say. Wearily, frustratedly, Finch shrugged and got to his feet, accompanied by Dominic, saying nothing but giving Wilson a contemptuous glare that all too eloquently said, "Roast in hell, you pompous bastard," and left.
an officer and a gentleman. Fuck off and die. 9.
You can do this,
Evie said to herself, taking a deep breath and looking down at the small piece of paper she had clutched in her hand. The same piece of paper with the address written on it that she'd taken from its place in the frame of her makeup mirror the night that all this had started. The night that had changed her life. Funny how you held on to things like that, even when everything else had descended into complete chaos. Well, if she was going to do it, it was time to make a start. Time to overcome that feeling of nervousness that she knew was only the surface symptom of an underlying dread she'd always felt, a fear of the world and all its parts. But sometimes that fear just had to be overcome, if only for a little while. Getting up off the bed, she left the room that had become hers, and returned along the passage to rejoin V. She found him sitting quietly, listening to soft music, masked and inscrutable as ever.
Hello,
she said tentatively, not even sure if he was actually awake behind that mask. And if he wasn't, was this the opportunity for one of those Phantom of the Opera moments? The unmasking, the hideous face, the horror? No. When she started to think of the possible consequences, it didn't seem like a good idea at all. And anyway, the nod of greeting he gave her showed he wasn't asleep at all.
I've been thinking,
she said hesitantly, sitting down on the couch and looking toward him like an actress not quite sure of her next line.
I want to ask you something, but I don't think you'll understand why, unless you know a few things about me.
Another nod from V. And now he sat up straighter, quite obviously giving her his full attention. That at least was encouraging, but still she found herself picking nervously at a thread on the couch. What she wanted to tell him brought back unpleasant memories that she preferred not to think about. The past, her own past particularly, didn't make for idle conversation.
"My father was a writer," she continued after a deep breath.
After all, he'd been so dear to her, with his unruly hair and glasses, his gangling frame and lopsided smile, that since he'd been gone, it was always painful to even think of him, let alone talk about him.
You would have liked him. He used to say that artists used lies to tell the truth, while politicians used them to cover the truth up.
A man after my own heart, V remarked briefly, softly.
He always told the best stories until—
A pause. Another deep breath.
Until my brother died. That was when everything changed. My brother was one of the pupils at St. Mary's.
And then the memories really did come back, with an overwhelming power. Memories so poignant they almost made her weep now, just as she'd wept so much then, so many years ago. The intensive care unit at the hospital, where she hadn't really understood what was going on, but they'd all had to wear masks over their mouths and noses, and it wasn't the sort of mask you wore to play games in. And Mummy had been crying, and Daddy had been trying not to, as he held her in his arms and did what he could to comfort her. And Evie had been standing there trying to get her fingers under the mask to wipe away the tears that kept streaming down her cheeks, as she looked through the plastic tent at little Timmy, whom she'd been angry at the day before for kicking his football at her, and who was lying there gasping for breath and covered with purple sores, and she'd never had the chance to say sorry for the nasty things she'd said to him about the football, and he'd never had the chance to forgive her for them, and she'd never forgiven herself for saying them in the first place, and she didn't understand it then, and she still didn't understand it now. But that was the last day she'd ever had with Timmy. They hadn't even been allowed to attend the cremation. And Timmy had been one of the lucky ones. One of the pupils they got out of the school alive, if only for a little while. As for the vast majority of the school kids who died on the spot and whose bodies had just melted together in a rotting, deliquescent mess before they could be identified, they'd just gone straight into a hole in the ground, pretty much there on the spot where they'd died. A throwback to the old plague pits in the days of the Black Death, only this time it was purple.
After he died,
Evie told V, pulling herself together as she moved on to memories less raw, yet only a little less painful.
My parents became political.
A bit of fun, it had seemed to her at the start,
standing in the street with her placard-bearing parents, wearing her school uniform and with her hair carefully braided into pigtails, handing out flyers to passing businessmen who usually promptly threw them away, and picking up the discarded leaflets and handing them out again. And again. The ones no one paid any attention to. The ones that were headed, "Viral Weapons Developed by U.S. Military for Use in the Middle East." That was another thing she hadn't quite understood at the time, but obviously it had meant a lot to her parents. Nobody stood out in the cold and rain and got shouted at, or worse, by passing crop-head youths, unless they thought it was important. That wasn't fun at all. She hadn't understood the leaflets demanding, "Stop the government lies," either. After all, only bad people told lies. And why would anyone vote for bad people?
"They protested against the war and the reclamation," continued Evie,
remembering how she'd been 10 years old at the time. That was when the Americans, after all their apparent successes in the Middle East, "creating a desert and calling it peace," Daddy had said, quoting some ancient author she couldn't remember, had finally overreached themselves and were forced to pay the price. Fortunately, by then, successive British governments had got into such hot water with their own electorate for their unthinking support for American military adventures that they'd closed the U.S. bases here and sent the missiles home, pretty much as the rest of old Europe had some years before. And the NATO alliance being defunct was probably what saved the country when the Taiwan crisis came. Of course, no one had really expected what happened then. When it turned out that the American military hammer failed to smash China apart like the crockery their propaganda machine kept comparing it to. It was the hammer that broke on the porcelain instead, though not without immense loss of life on both sides. Then the hand that wielded the hammer had broken too, and the second American Civil War had begun. And hadn't finished yet, though both sides seemed to have fought themselves into an exhausted stalemate now. It was one of those situations that cried out for international intervention. But before the war, the Americans had destroyed the United Nations, when it wouldn't just roll over and do what they wanted it to. England hadn't been immune to the chaos that had washed over the entire world like a tsunami after the war, with the collapse of international trade, the transnational banking system, and the food supply. With the oil crisis and the petty wars in South America, as the various states struggled for supremacy in the power vacuum left when the United States followed the United Nations into functional oblivion, and perhaps, worst of all, the changes to the global weather system. Evie could still remember how the Thames Barrier had burst and flooded most of London. More people had died then than from the St. Mary's virus. But that had been a natural disaster, so no one could make much political capital out of that, except for the religious right. But they saw the hand of God in everything, so everyone regarded them as a joke. And they were, compared to what was coming next. Because then the fascists had won the election, and started the reclamation. That hideous excuse for an orgy of ethnic, political, religious, and moral cleansing, in the name of reclaiming England for the English, and its appeal for Victorian values. The sort of values that had prevailed when the British Empire had still straddled half the globe, and maps of the world were printed mostly pink, that harked back to times when it was the white man's burden to bring enlightenment to the heathen savages. Only this time around the white man was disburdening himself of the heathen savages as rapidly and brutally as he could, and everyone who didn't believe in the one true God whose name was Jesus Christ, and who didn't have the right family values, and who was principled enough not to swallow the party line.
"When Sattler was appointed High Chancellor," Evie went on, "they were at the riot at Leeds. I watched it on the telly thinking I was going to see my parents killed. I remember them arguing at night. Mum wanted to leave the country. Dad refused. He said that if we ran away, they'd win. Win. Like it was a game."
And then there was the other memory, the second of the two that she always did her best not to think about, especially at night, especially just before dawn, the one that kept coming back anyway. The worst one, more awful yet than Timmy, the one she'd remembered that very morning when she'd confused it with the soundtrack of The Count of Monte Cristo. She'd been asleep too when that had started. Started with the sound of breaking glass, and the sound of a heavy iron ram battering in the front door. The heavy footsteps of metal-shod boots, the shouting, the gunshot.
They should have expected it. It had been happening all across the country, and to people they knew as well. But when friends stopped getting in touch, it was far easier to delude yourself that there must be some minor reason for it, other than what you knew in your heart to be true. And always there was the feeling that these things only happened to other people, that it would never happen to us. But then nobody had really expected a fascist government would happen either. It was just after the gunshot, no more than a warning shot as it turned out, that her mother had burst into her bedroom, nightdress clad, and slammed the door behind her.
"Evie, quick!" she'd said with quiet desperation, hoping the intruders might not hear. "Hide! Under the bed!"
And she had, though not without her favourite Teddy, the one she'd always talked to in her troubles, the one who knew the magic word that took them off on dream adventures, to a world where everything was lovely, now grabbed one-handed without thought. Then the door had been broken in, knocking her mother to the floor and revealing not the police they'd always half expected, but soldiers. Brutal, coarse, laughing among themselves as they ogled her mother in her nightdress, dragging her to her feet and pinning her arms behind her back, speedily fastening her wrists with plastic zip-ties, and not caring where they put their hands as they did so. Evie, huddled desperately beneath the bed and overwhelmed with panic, found she could hardly breathe at all, only managing tiny mouse-like gasps. She looked up in absolute desperation to see her mother looking straight back at her, as if to fix her daughter's image in her mind forever, just before they pulled the shiny black bag down over her head. Then Evie had screamed helplessly, all control completely lost, and the flashlights had stabbed under the bed. And the soldiers had found her, and taken her away.
"I never saw them again,"
Evie told V, struggling with things she never talked about, and remembering then, with pathetic absurdity, that she'd never seen Teddy again either.
"It was like those black bags erased them from the face of the earth."
Erased the magic word as well, and all the magic that had ever been in the world, and then there was nothing left but fear. Cold, dark fear that lived somewhere near the bottom of her spine, and, at the slightest opportunity, would suddenly rush up and engulf her entire brain and seep throughout her mind. "I'm sorry, Evie," V said gently, and with an obvious sympathy that transcended the usual platitudes.
"No, I'm the one that's sorry," she said,
trying to gather herself only to fall prey to another memory, of how, at times like these, so near to tears, her mother would always smile and tell her gently to
blow your nose and pull yourself together.
But ever since she'd said that for the last time, it seemed somehow that nose-blowing didn't help.
"I'm sorry that I'm not a stronger person. I'm sorry I'm not like my parents. I wish I was, but I'm not. I wish I wasn't afraid all the time, but I am."
She sucked in a deep breath then, steeling herself to say the words that all this had been leading up to.
"I know this world is screwed up. Believe me, I know it better than most, which is why I wanted to ask. If there's anything I can do to help make it right, please, let me know."
"If you wish," murmured V quietly. "If you wish." Another request, meanwhile, had been made at another ministry. This time one of the civilian, and infinitely more civil, ones. But still Finch and Dominic waited with growing impatience at the issue desk. How long did these things take? The rain had been coming down so hard when they'd arrived, in stair rods, as Finch's old mum had used to say, which was a stage quite beyond the usual raining cats and dogs, that they got soaked just walking into the building from their parked car. Now they'd been waiting so long, they were almost perfectly dry again. Mind you, it was Saturday morning, and though he and Dominic were prepared to put in the extra hours, they'd had to call out someone specially to help them here. And no doubt the man would be putting in for time and a half for Saturday work. So maybe it wasn't surprising that he was dragging it out for as long as he could. Or maybe it did just take this long. "You really think we'll find something here?" Dominic asked the elder man, as much to make conversation as anything else. "Worth a shot," Finch told him, wondering what it was these days that seemed to have deprived the nation's civil servants of coffee.
One thing is true about all governments. Their best records are tax records. At last, a door opened on the other side of the room, and the grey-haired, bifocaled filing clerk they'd first spoken to, a forgotten age ago, reappeared. Stooping slightly, he meandered across the office toward them, carrying a large box file. The expression on his face didn't look at all hopeful.
"It appears that the original electronic records have all been lost, probably during the reclamation," he said apologetically, seeing disappointment slide across the faces of the detectives like curtains closing on the casket at a crematorium. "A lot of things went missing back then, but I found this hard copy filed down in the vaults."
Still with a rather apologetic expression, he handed the box to Finch.
"Everything we've got on Lark Hill is in there."
And then he glanced up, almost in wonder, to see the look of grateful surprise dawning on Finch's lined and world-weary face.
"Thanks," Finch told him, for once meaning it quite sincerely. "This is a big help."
Christ, he thought, if only things always turned up like this. This book is continued on Disc 4.